Mr. Clinch.
Yes, said Clinch. What is it?
I have a question, Taufare said.
Well then, ask.
Why did you buy the cottage of Crosby Wills?
The hotelier groaned.
Not that, he said. Let's not talk about that. Not tonight.
Why?
Just leave it,
Clinch snapped.
I'm out of humour. I'm not discussing Crosby bloody Wells.
He was watching the widow as she moved from guest to guest. Her crinoline was so wide that she parted the crowd wherever she walked, leaving an aisle of space behind her.
She has a cruel face, Taufare observed.
Yes, Clinch said. I think so too.
Not a friend of Maori.
No, I expect not. Nor the Chinese, as we can very well see. Nor of any man in this room, I don't doubt.
Clinch drained his glass.
I'm out of humour, Mr. Taufare, he said again. When I am out of humour, do you know what I like to do? I like to drink.
That's good, Taufare said.
Clinch reached for the decanter.
You'll have another?
Yes.
He refilled both their glasses.
Anyway, he said, as he returned the decanter to the sideboard, the appeal will go through, and the sale will be revoked, and I'll get my deposit back, and that will be that. The cottage won't belong to me any longer. It will belong to Mrs. Wells.
What did you buy? Taufare persisted.
Clinch exhaled heavily.
It wasn't even my idea, he said. It was Charlie Frost's idea. Buy up some land, he said. That way nobody will ask any questions.
Taufare said nothing, waiting for Clinch to go on. Presently he did.
Here's the argument, he said. You don't need a miner's right if the land's your very own, do you? And if you find a piece of gold on your own land, it's yours, isn't it? That was the idea. His idea, I mean. It wasn't mine. I couldn't take the gowns to the bank, not without a miner's right. They'd ask where it came from, and then I'd be stuck. But if I had a piece of land for my very own, then nobody asks anything at all. I never knew about Johnny Quay, you see. I thought the gold had been in the dresses all along, still pure. So I saved up for a deposit. Charlie said to wait for either a deceased estate or a subdivision. Either the one or the other, he said, for the sake of staying clean. So when the Wells tract came up for sale, I bought it first thing, thinking that, well, I don't know. It was stupid. Settling there with, I don't know. Of course, Anna comes home from jail in a different dress the very next day, and then after she quits the place, I find out the other dresses have been stripped. It was the leaden makeweights that I was feeling. The whole plan's gone to custard. I've got a piece of land I don't want, and no money to call me own, and Anna, well, you know about her.
Taufare was frowning.
The Arahura is a very sacred place, he began.
Yes, well, said Clinch, waving a hand to silence him. The law's the law. If you want to buy the cottage back again, you're more than welcome. But it's not me you should be talking to, it's her.
They gazed across the room at Mrs. Wells.
The problem with beautiful women, Clinch said presently, is that they always know it, and the knowing turns them proud. I like a woman who doesn't know her own beauty.
A stupid woman, Taufare said.
Not stupid, Clinch said. Modest. Unassuming.
Oh, I do not know those words.
Clinch waved a hand.
Doesn't say too much. Doesn't speak about herself. Knows when to keep quiet, and knows when to speak.
Cunning,
said Taufare.
Not cunning,
Clinch shook his head.
Not cunning and not stupid either. Just careful and quiet and innocent.
Who is this woman? Said Taufare slyly.
No, this isn't a real woman, said Clinch.
He scowled.
Never mind.
Hi, Edgar. Do you have a moment?
Lerventhal had come up behind them.
By all means, said Clinch. Excuse me, Mr. Taufare.
Lerventhal blinked, seeing Taufare for the first time.
You must have gone down to the wreck, he said. Find anything?
Taufari did not like to be addressed with condescension, as though he belonged to a servile class. Nor could he forgive Löwenthal for having shamed him earlier that day.
"No," he replied scornfully, "nothing."
"Pity," said Löwenthal, already turning away.
"What's on your mind, Ben?"
said Clinch, when they were alone.
"It's an indelicate question, I'm afraid," said Löwenthal, "about the child of Annis, the baby that never came to term."
"All right," said Clinch cautiously.
"You recall the night I found her, after the dust-up with Carver?"
"Of course."
"That was the night she confessed that Carver was the child's father."
"Yes, I remember."
"I would like to know whether you knew that fact already, or whether, like me, you heard that confession for the first time that evening,"
Löwenthal said.
"You will please forgive my indelicacy and the impertinence of the subject in question."
Clinch was silent for a long time.
"No," he said at last, "that was the first time she spoke of it. She kept mum on the subject until that night."
"But did you have an inkling?" Löwenthal pressed.
"Some idea.
Were you of the opinion, perhaps, that Carver might have been the sire?"
Clinch looked uncomfortable.
"It was some fellow from Dunedin days," he said. "That's all I knew. It wasn't a Hokitika chap. The months didn't match up."
"And Carver knew Anna in Dunedin?"
"She came over on Godspeed," Clinch said shortly. "Beyond that, I couldn't tell you. What's this in aid of?"
Löwenthal explained what had happened in the office of the West Coast Times that afternoon.
"Anna might not have been telling the truth, you see. She might have been spinning us a line. Of course, we never had reason to doubt her word. Until now."
Clinch scowled.
"But who else could it be, if not Carver?"
Löwenthal pursed his lips.
"I don't know," he said. "Any number of men, I suppose. Perhaps it's no one we know."
"This is just Carver's word against Anna's," Clinch said hotly. "You aren't taking Carver's part on the strength of a single declaration. Any man can deny a thing, you know. It doesn't cost a man a penny to deny a thing."
"I'm not taking eyes apart yet," Löwenthal said, "but I do think that the timing of Anna's confession could be significant. Perhaps."
Frowning, Clinch reached up to stroke the side of his face. As he did so, Löwenthal caught the spice of his cologne and realized that Clinch must have paid for a scented shave at the barbershop, rather than the penny lather that was the standing order of most Hokitika men, a guess that was further confirmed when Clinch moved his hand and Löwenthal saw a reddish spray of irritation upon the man's soft cheeks. Discreetly, Löwenthal looked the hotelier up and down. Clinch's jacket had been brushed and his collar starched. The shirt he was wearing seemed very white, and the toes of his boots were freshly blackened.
"Oh," Löwenthal thought with pity, "he made himself handsome for Anna."
"So she only named the father after the child was dead,"
Clinch said at last, and in a very harsh voice.
"That's a whore's honour. That's all it is."
"Perhaps you're right," Löwenthal said more kindly. "Let's drop the subject."
"Mr. Walter Moody, Mrs. Lydia Wells," said Gascoigne. "Mr. Moody is come to Hokitika from Scotland, Mrs. Wells, to make his fortune in the gorge. Mrs. Wells, as you will know, Mr. Moody, is the mistress of this establishment and a great enthusiast of realms."
Lydia made a very pretty curtsy, and Moody a short but respectful bow. Moody then paid the necessary compliments to his hostess, thanking her very nicely for the evening's entertainment and praising her renovations of the old hotel. Despite his best efforts, the compliments came out very flat. When he looked at her, he thought only of Lauderback and Crosby Wells. When he had finished speaking, she said,
"Do you have an interest in the occult, Mr. Moody?
a question which Moody could not answer honestly without risking offence. He paused only a moment, however, before replying, "There are many things that are yet arcane to me, Mrs. Wells, and I hope that I am a curious man. If I am interested in those truths that are yet unknown, it is only so that they might in time be made known, or to put it more plainly, so that in time I might come to know them."
"You are wonderfully free with one verb, I notice," the widow returned. "What does it mean for you, Mr. Moody, to know something? I fancy you put rather a lot of stock in knowing, judging from the way you speak."
Moody smiled. "Why," he said, "I suppose that to know a thing is to see it from all sides."
"To see it from all sides,"
the widow repeated. "But I confess you catch me off guard. I've not spent any time working on the definition, and should not like to hear it quoted back to me. At least, not until I've spent some time thinking about how I might defend it."
"No," the widow agreed. "Your definition leaves much to be desired. There are so many exceptions to the rule. How could one possibly see a spirit from all sides, for example? The notion is incredible."
Moody gave another short bow. "You're quite right to name that as an exception, Mrs. Wells. But I'm afraid I do not believe a spirit can be known at all by anyone, and I certainly do not believe a spirit can be seen. I do not mean to impugn your talents in the slightest, but there it is. I do not believe in spirits, categorically."
"And yet you applied for a ticket to the séance this evening," the widow pointed out.
"My curiosity was piqued."
"By the particular spirit in question, perhaps?"
"Mr. Staines?" Moody shrugged. "I've never met the man. I arrived in Hokitika some fortnight after he disappeared. But since then I've heard his name many times, of course."
"Mr. Gascoigne says that you have come to Hokitika to make your fortune."
"Yes, so I hope."
"And how will you make it?"
"By dint of hard work and good planning, I expect."
"Of course, there are many rich men who work little and plan nothing at all."
"Those men are lucky," Moody said.
"Do you not wish to be lucky also?"
"I wish to be able to call myself deserving of my lot," Moody said carefully. "Luck is by nature undeserved."
"What an honourable answer," said Lydia Wells.
"And a truthful one, I hope," said Moody.
"Aha," said the widow. "We are back to truth again."
Gascoigne had been watching Lydia Wells.
"You see how her mind is working," he said to Moody. "She will swoop down in a moment and savage your argument. Prepare yourself."
"I hardly know how to prepare to be savaged," Moody said. Gascoigne was right. The widow lifted her chin and said,
"Are you a man of religion, Mr. Moody?"
"I am a man of philosophy," he rejoined. "Those aspects of religion that can be called philosophy interest me extremely. Those that cannot, do not."
"I see," said Lydia Wells. "I am afraid that in my case it is quite the reverse. It is only those philosophies that can be called religions that hold any interest for me."
Gascoigne laughed outright at this.
"Very good," he said, wagging his finger. "That is very good."
Moody was amused, despite himself, by the widow's acuity, but he was determined not to let her take the upper hand. "It seems that we have little in common, Mrs. Wells," he said. "I hope that this lack of common ground will not be an impediment to friendship."
"We disagree upon the validity of spirits. We have established that much," said Lydia Wells. "But let me put the contrary question to you. What about a soul, a living soul? Do you believe that you can know a person who is living if you cannot know a person who is dead?"
Moody considered this, smiling. After a moment, the widow went on.
"Do you believe that you could ever truly know your friend Mr. Gascoigne, for example? Can you see him from all sides?"
Gascoigne looked very peeved for having been used as a rhetorical example, and said so aloud. The widow shushed him, and put the question to Moody a second time. Moody looked at Gascoigne. In fact, he'd anatomized Gascoigne's character to a very fine degree of detail over the 3 weeks of their acquaintance. He felt that he understood the scope and limits of the man's intelligence, the quality of his sentiment, and the tenor of his many expressions and habits. He felt, as a whole, that he could summarize the man's character very accurately. But he knew that Lydia Wells was intending to trap him, and in the end he chose to reply very blandly indeed, repeating that he had only arrived in Hokitika but 3 weeks ago, and could not hope to form an accurate assessment of Gascoigne's soul in such a time. That project, he added, would require more than 3 weeks of observation.
"Mr. Moody was Mr. Carver's passenger," Gascoigne put in. "He arrived on the Godspeed that very night she came to ground."
Moody felt a stirring of unease at this disclosure. He had used a false name while booking his passage upon Godspeed, and he did not like to advertise the fact that he had arrived in Hokitika upon that craft, given the nature of what he had witnessed, or imagined that he had witnessed, in the hours before the ship had foundered. He looked at the widow, seeking in her face some flicker of doubt or recognition that might show that she had known about the bloody phantom in Godspeed's hold. But Lydia Wells was smiling.
"Did he?" she said, looking Moody up and down. "Then I'm afraid Mr. Moody is a very common specimen of a man indeed."
"How so?" Moody said stiffly. The widow laughed.
"You are a lucky man who is scornful of the notion of luck," she said. "I'm afraid, Mr. Moody, that I have met a great many men like you."
Before Moody could think of a reply to this, she picked up a small silver bell, rang it sharply, and announced, in a voice that was no less penetrating for its husky half-whisper, that all those without tickets were to make their departures at once, for the sales was about to begin. Venus in Aquarius, in which Sukyong Sheng forgets his shilling, Lydia Wells becomes hysterical, and we receive an answer from the realm of the dead. What a different gathering this was to the clandestine council that had assembled in the Crown Hotel 3 weeks ago. The Crown had played host to a party of 12, which, following Moody's arrival, became a party of 13. Here, in the front room of the Wayfarer's Fortune, there were a party of 11 seeking to summon a 12th. Charlie Frost, under Joseph Pritchard's instruction, kept his eyes fixed upon Lydia Wells as the widow led the 7 ticket holders into the parlour where Ah Suk and Ah Kui, shining with grease paint, sat cross-legged on either side of the hearth. The drapes had been drawn over the parlour windows, and all but one of the paraffin lamps had been doused, giving the room a pinkish glow. Above this last lamp, a tin dish of attar had been placed on a metal stand, and the liquid, gently heated by the warmth of the flame, filled the room with the pleasant scent of roses. Mrs. Wells invited the men to take their seats, which, in the interval while the other guests departed the wayfarer's fortune and dispersed into the night, had been arranged in a circle in the middle of the room. There was much embarrassment and nervousness in the room as the 7 guests were seated. One man kept emitting a high-pitched giggle. Others grinned and elbowed their mates in the ribs. Mrs. Wells paid these disturbances no notice. She was busy arranging 5 candles in a star pattern upon a plate and lighting them one by one. When the candles were lit and the paper spill extinguished, Lydia Wells seated herself at last and remarked, in a voice that was suddenly hushed and conspiratorial, that Anna Wetherill, these hours past, had been preparing her mind for the impending communion with the dead. She was not to be spoken to when she made her entrance in the parlour, for even the smallest disturbance could disrupt her state of mind, which in turn would disrupt the widow's own transmissions. Did the present company consent to ignore her? The present company consented. Did the present company consent to assist the widow's transmissions further by maintaining a state of mental receptivity for the duration of the event? Would every man agree to keep his mind cool and open, his limbs relaxed, his breathing deep and rhythmic, and his attention focused absolutely, like that of a monk at prayer? This was assured.
I cannot tell you what will happen in this room tonight," the widow went on, still speaking in a voice of conspiracy. "Perhaps the furniture will move about. Perhaps we will feel breezes, the breath of the underworld, some might call it, as the spirits around us are disturbed. Perhaps the dead will speak through the mouths of the living. Or perhaps they will reveal themselves by the presentation of a token."
"What do you mean, a token?" one of the diggers said.
Lydia Wells turned her calm gaze upon the speaker.
"Sometimes," she said quietly, "and for reasons unknown to us, the dead are unable to speak. When this happens, they choose to communicate in other ways. I was party to a séance in Sydney where this occurred."
"What happened?"
Mrs. Wells became glazed.
"A woman had been killed in her own home," she said, "under circumstances that were a touch mysterious. And some months following her death, a select group of spiritists convened at her house to contact her."
"How was she killed?"
"The family dog went savage," said Lydia Wells. "Quite out of character, the beast attacked her and ripped out her throat."
"Hideous! Ghastly!"
"The circumstances of her death were suspicious," the widow continued, "not least because the dog was shot before its true nature could be established by the law. But the case was closed, and the woman's husband, wild with grief, quit the house and sailed away. Some months later, a servant who had been employed in the house brought the matter to a medium's attention. We arranged for a séance to be held in the very room in which this woman had been killed. A gentleman in our group, not the medium, but another spiritist of high renown, happened to be wearing a pocket watch that evening. The watch was tucked inside his vest pocket, with the chain pinned to his breast. He had wound it, he assured us afterwards, before he arrived at the house, and the piece kept very good time. Well, that night, during the séance, there came a queer little whirring noise from his vest. We all heard it, though we did not know what it was. He retrieved the piece, and found to his astonishment that the dial now read 1:03. He insisted that he had wound the watch at 6 o'clock, and it was not yet 9. There was no way that the hands could have moved so far on their own accord, and he could hardly have turned the knob by accident. He tried the knob, and found that it had stuck. It was broken. In fact, the piece never worked again."
"But what did it mean?" someone said. 1:03.
The widow's voice became low.
"We could only assume," she said, "that the spirit of the dead woman was trying to tell us something, very urgently. The time of her death, perhaps? Or was she delivering a warning, a death that was yet to come?"
Charlie Frost found that he was breathing shallowly.
"What's happened next?" Nielsen whispered. "We decided to stay in the drawing room until 1:03 in the morning," said Lydia Wells. "Perhaps, we thought, the spirit was inviting us to stay until that time, at which point something was to happen. We waited until the hour struck 1. We waited in silence for 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3, and then exactly at that moment there was a terrible crash. A painting tumbled from its hook upon the wall. We all turned and saw behind it a hole in the plaster. The painting had been put up, you see, to mask the hole. Well, the women in the group were screaming. There was noise all about. You can imagine the commotion. Someone found a knife and cut out the piece of plaster, and lo and behold, lodged into the plaster, there was a ball of shot."
Frost and Nielsen exchanged a quick glance. The widow's story had reminded them both of the bullet that had vanished from Anna Wetherill's bedchamber in the upper room of the Gridiron Hotel.
"Was the case ever solved?" somebody said.
"Oh, yes," the widow said. "I shan't go into the details. There are too many. But you can look it all up in the papers if you're curious. You see, the woman was never savaged by a dog at all. She had been murdered by her own husband, and he'd shot the dog and slashed her throat himself to cover it up."
There were murmurs of distress around the room.
"Yes," said Lydia Wells. "Tragic, the whole story. Elizabeth something, the woman's name was. I forget the last name. Well, the good news was that when the case reopened, they had two clues on their side. First, that she had been killed by a ball from a Colt Army handgun, and second, that the precise time of her death was 1:03.
The widow was quiet for a moment, and then she laughed.
But you aren't here tonight to hear me tell tales.
She rose from her chair. Several of the assembled men made to rise, also out of politeness, but the widow put up her hand, stalling them.
I regret to say that the sceptics of the world are very many, she said, and for every good-hearted man there are 10 more who are not good at all. There may be men among you who will attempt to deny whatever happens tonight, or who will attempt to discredit me. I invite you all to look around you now, and to reassure yourselves that this room contains no tricks or deceits or follies of any kind. I know as well as you that there are many pretenders in the art of fortune-telling, but you may rest assured that I am not one of them.
She spread her arms and said,
You can see that I'm concealing nothing on my person. Don't worry, you are free to look.
There was tittering at this, and much shuffling as the men looked around them, examining the ceiling, the chairs, the paraffin lamp on the table, the candles, the rug upon the floor. Charlie Frost kept his eyes on Lydia Wells. She did not look tense. She twirled around, revealing that she was hiding nothing in her skirts, and then seated herself very easily, smiling at the room at large. She picked at a loose thread upon her sleeve, and waited until the men were still.
Excellent, she said,
when the collective attention had focused upon her once again.
Now that we are all happy and ready, I shall cut the lights and await Anna's arrival.
She leant forward and doused the paraffin lamp, plunging them all into the gloom of candlelight. After several seconds of quiet, there came 3 knocks at the parlour door behind them, and Lydia Wells, still fussing over the lamp, called,
Come!
The door opened, and the 7 men turned. Frost, forgetting Pritchard's instruction for a moment, looked too. Anna was standing in the doorway with an expression of ghostly vacancy upon her face. She was still wearing the mourning dress she'd been gifted by Aubert Gascoigne, but if the dress had been ill-fitting once, it looked wretched on her now. The gown hung from her shoulders as though from a rail. The waist, though plainly cinched, was loose, and the tatted collar masked an almost concave breast. Her face was very pale, her expression sombre. She did not look at the faces of the assembled crowd. With her eyes fixed upon the middle distance, she came forward, slowly, and sank into the vacant armchair facing Lydia Wells. Why, thought Frost as she sat down, she is starving. He glanced at Nielsen, meaning to catch the other man's eye, but Nielsen was frowning at Anna, an expression of grave perplexity upon his face. Too late, Frost remembered his own assignation and turned back to the widow, who in the brief moment while every man's head was turned towards the door had done something. Yes, she had done something, certainly, for she was smoothing down her dress in a self-conscious, satisfied way, and her expression had suddenly become brisk. What had she done? What had she altered? In the dim light, he could not tell. Frost cursed himself for having looked away. This was just the kind of subterfuge that Pritchard had predicted. He vowed that he would not look away a second time. The corners of the room had now vanished entirely into black. The only light came from the flickering glow of the candles in the center of the group, and around it the 11 faces had a graying, ghostly look. Without taking his eyes from the widow's face, Frost noted that, in fact, the circle of chairs was not perfectly circular. It was more nearly an ellipsis, placed with its longest axis pointing to the door, and Lydia seated at its farthest end. By placing the seats in this configuration, she had been able to ensure that every man's head would turn towards the door and away from her when Anna arrived. Well, Frost thought, the Chinese men, at least, must have seen the sleight of hand that she had performed in that quick instant when Anna appeared in the doorway. He made a second mental note, to question them once the seance was over. The group now joined hands at the widow's instruction, And then, in the fluttering light of the candles, Lydia Wells heaved a great sigh, smiled, and closed her eyes. The widow's visitation took a very long time coming. The group sat in perfect silence for nigh on 20 minutes, each man holding himself very still, breathing rhythmically, and waiting for a sign. Charlie Frost kept his eyes on Mrs. Wells. At length, she set up a humming sound, low at the back of her throat. The humming thickened, a quiet pitch. Soon one could make out words, some nonsensical, some recognizable only by their shapes, their syllables. These, too, thickened into phrases, entreaties, commands. Finally, Mrs. Wells, arching her back, made her request of the world of the dead to give up the shade of Emery Staines. Later, Frost would describe the scene that followed as variously a fit, a seizure, and a prolonged convulsion. He knew that none of these explanations was quite right, for none conveyed accurately either the elaborate theatrics of Lydia Wells' performance or Frost's acute embarrassment in witnessing them. Mrs. Wells called out Staines' name again and again, intoning the words with a lover's dying fall. And when no answer came, she became agitated. She suffered paroxysms. She repeated syllables like a babbling child. Her head lolled against her chest, reared back, lolled again. Presently her convulsions began approaching a kind of climax. Her breathing became faster and faster, and then suddenly quelled. Her eyes snapped open. Charlie Frost felt a cold jolt of unease. Lydia Wells was staring directly at him, and the expression on her face was unlike any he had seen her wear before. It was rigid, bloodless, fierce. But then the flames from the candles ducked and leapt, and he saw that Lydia Wells was not looking at him, but past him, over his shoulder, to where Ah Sook sat in the corner in his oriental pose. Frost did not blink. He did not look away. Then Lydia Wells gave a strange sound. Her eyes rolled back in her head. The muscles in her throat began to pulse. Her mouth moved strangely, as though she were chewing on the air. And then, in a voice that did not belong to her, she said,
"Go ye the way, mutak moi de ga suk ye ming sing dong wai wai, no ge sing you fu zak. Mao leon ne hai bin, dung no ko yung gam ko tlai. Go ya ding ui wan dao ne, go yo wan ne bao zao."
And she gave a great shudder and pitched sideways onto the floor. In the very same moment, Frost would discuss this inexplicable event with Nielsen for weeks to come. The paraffin lamp on the table lurched violently to the side, coming down upon the plate of candles that had been set out next to it. This was a mistake that ought to have been very easily righted, for the glass globe of the lamp did not shatter and the paraffin did not spill. But there was a colossal whoosh of flame, and the circle of men was suddenly illuminated. The entire surface of the table was burning. In the next moment, everyone burst into life. Someone shouted to cover the fire. One of the diggers pulled the widow to safety, and two others cleared the sofa. The fire was doused with shawls and blankets. The lamp was knocked away. Everyone was talking at once. Charlie Frost, wheeling round in the sudden darkness, saw that Anna Wetherill had not moved, and her expression had not changed. The sudden blaze of the fire did not seem to have alarmed her in the slightest. Someone lit the lamp.
"Was that it? Was that what's supposed to happen? What did she say? Clear a space, would you? Cool to see us all lit up like that. Some kind of primitive... Make sure she's breathing.
Have to admit, I didn't expect...
Did it mean anything, do you think? What she said, or was it...
That wasn't Emery Staines, sure as I'm...
Another spirit, working through...
The way the lamp moved of its own accord like that.
We ought to ask the Johnnies. Oi, was that Chinese? Does he understand? Was that Chinese that she was speaking just now?"
But Ah Kui did not appear to understand the question. One of the diggers leant over and tapped him on the shoulder.
"What was that, eh?"
he said.
"What was it that she said? Was it Chinese what she was saying? Or some other tongue?"
Ah Kui returned his gaze without understanding and did not speak. It was Ah Sook who answered.
"Lydia Wells speak Cantonese,"
he said.
"Yes?"
Nielsen said eagerly, swivelling about.
And what did she say?
Ah Suk studied him.
One day I come back and kill you. You kill a man. He die, so you die. I come back and kill you one day.
Nielsen's eyes went wide. His next question died on his lips. He turned to Anna, who was looking at Ah Suk, her expression faintly perplexed. Charlie Frost was frowning.
Where's Staines in all of that?
Demanded one of the diggers. Ah Suk shook his head.
Not Staines,
he said quietly. He got up from his cushion suddenly and walked to the window, folding his arms.
Not Staines,
said the digger.
Who then?
Francis Carver,
said Ah Suk. There was an explosion of outrage around the room.
Francis Carver? How's that for a séance, when he isn't even dead? Why, I could talk to Carver myself. I'd only have to knock upon his door.
But he's at the palace, said another.
That's 50 yards away from where you are.
That's not the point. I mean, you can't deny that something strange.
I could have talked to Carver myself,
the digger repeated stubbornly.
I don't need a medium for that.
What about the lamp, though? How do you account for the lamp? It jumped across the room.
It levitated.
Ah Suk had stiffened.
Francis Carver, he said, directing his question to Harold Nielsen. At the Palace Hotel.
Nielsen frowned. Surely Ah Suk knew this already. Yes, Carver's staying at the palace, he said, on Revel Street. The building with the blue edging, you know, next to the hardware store.
How long? Said Ah Suk.
Nielsen looked even more confused.
He's been here for 3 weeks,
he said, lowering his voice.
Since the night, I mean, since the Godspeed came to ground.
The other men were still arguing.
It's not a séance unless it's talking with the dead.
No, when you talk to Carver, it's you who ends up dead.
They laughed at this, and then the digger's mate said,
Rum do, you thinking? Some kind of a hoax?
The stubborn digger looked inclined to agree, but he cast a glance over at Lydia Wells. The widow was still unconscious, and her face was very pale. Her mouth was partly open, showing the glint of a molar and a dry tongue, and her eyes were fluttering weakly beneath the lids. If she was shamming, the digger thought, then she was shamming extraordinarily well. But he had paid for a communion with Emery Staines. He had not paid to hear a string of Chinese syllables and then watch a woman fall into a faint. Why, how could he be sure that the words were even Chinese? She might have been speaking gibberish. The Chinese fellow might be in on the secret, and she might have paid him a fee to corroborate the lie. But the digger had a cowardly temperament. He did not voice these opinions aloud.
Wouldn't want to say,
he said at last, but he still looked surly.
Well, we'll ask her when she comes around.
Frank Carver speaks Chinese,
one of the others said in a voice of incredulity.
He goes back and forth from Canton, does he not?
Born in Hong Kong?
Yes, but to speak the language, as they do,
makes you think different of the man.
At this point, the digger, who had been discharged to the kitchen, returned with a glass of water and threw it across Lydia's face. Gasping, she revived. The men crowded closer, asking in an anxious chorus after her health and safety, so that it was some moments before the widow had a chance to respond. Lydia Wells looked from face to face in some confusion. After a moment, she even managed a weak laugh. But her laughter was without its usual surety, and as she accepted a glass of Andalusian brandy from the man at her elbow, her hand visibly trembled. She drank, and in the moments that followed, all manner of questions were put to her. What had she seen? What could she remember? Whom had she channeled? Had she made any contact with Emery Staines? Her answers were disappointing. She could remember nothing at all from the point she fell into her trance, which was unusual, she said, for usually she could recall her visions very well indeed. The men prompted her, but without success. She simply could not remember anything at all. When it was revealed to her that she had spoken in a foreign tongue, quite fluently and for some time, she looked genuinely puzzled.
But I don't know a word of Chinese, she said. Are you sure? And the Johnnies confirmed it. Real Chinese, you're really sure?
This was confirmed with much perplexity and excitement.
And what is all this mess?
She gestured weakly at the scorched table and the remains of the fire.
The lamp just fell, said one of the diggers. It just fell of its own accord. It did more than fall, it levitated.
Lydia looked at the paraffin lamp a moment, and then seemed to rouse herself.
Well,
she raised herself a little higher on the sofa.
So I channeled the ghost of a Chinaman.
Interference wasn't what I paid for, the stubborn digger said.
No, said Lydia Wells soothingly. No, of course it wasn't. Of course we must refund the cost of all your tickets. But tell me, what were the very words I spoke?
Something to do with a murder, said Frost, who was still watching her very closely.
Something to do with revenge. Indeed,
said Mrs. Wells. She seemed impressed.
Ah, Sook said it had something to do with Francis Carver, said Frost.
Mrs. Wells went pale. She started forward.
What were the very words, the exact words?
The diggers looked around them, but perceived only Arqui, who returned their gaze stonily and did not speak.
He doesn't have English. Where's the other one? Where did he go?
Ah-Suk had extracted himself from the group some minutes before, padding from the room and into the foyer so quietly that nobody had noticed his departure. The revelation that Francis Carver had returned to Hokitika, that he had been in Hokitika for 3 weeks, had caused a flood of private emotion in his breast, and he desired all of a sudden to be alone. He leant against the rail of the porch and looked out down the long arm of Revel Street towards the quay. The long row of hanging lanterns formed a doubled seam of light that came together in a haze of yellow some 200 yards to the south. Their brightness was so intense that upon the camber of the street it might have been high noon, and the shadows of the alleys were made all the blacker by contrast. A pair of drunks staggered past him, clutching one another around the waist. A whore passed in the other direction, her skirts gathered high above her knees. She looked at him curiously, and Ah-Suk, after a moment of blankness, remembered that his face was still heavily painted, the corners of his eyes lengthened with kohl, his cheeks rounded with white. She called out to him, but he shook his head and she walked on. From somewhere nearby there came a sudden roar of laughter and applause. Ah-Suk sucked his lips between his teeth. So Francis Carver had returned to Hokitika once again. He surely was not aware that his old associate was living in a hut at Kenyeri, less than 5 miles away. Carver was not a man to bear a risk if he could remove the threat of that risk altogether. In that case, Ah-Suk thought, perhaps he, Ah-Suk, had the advantage. He sucked again at his teeth, and then after a moment shook his head. No, Lydia Wells had recognized him that morning. She would surely have relayed the news to Carver at once. Inside, the conversation had returned to the subject of the paraffin lamp, a trick that Ah-Suk had already dismissed out of hand. Lydia Wells had merely slipped a loop of thread over the knob of the lamp at the moment she doused it. The thread was the same colour as her dress, and the other end of it was affixed to the inside of her wrist. One sharp twitch of her right hand and the lamp would fall over the candles. The small table upon which the candles were burning had been coated with paraffin oil, which had the virtues of being both odourless and colourless, such that to an outsider the table might have seemed merely clean. At first contact with the naked flame, however, the surface of the table was sure to ignite. It was all a charade, a sham. Mrs. Wells had not made any kind of communion with the realm of the dead, and the words that she had spoken were not the words of a dead man. Ah-Suk knew this, because the words were his own. The whore had lingered in the thoroughfare. She now called out to the men on the veranda opposite and lifted the flounces of her skirt a little higher. The men called back in response, and one leapt up to caper. Ah-Suk watched them with a distant expression. He marvelled at the strange power of feminine hysteria, that Lydia Wells might have remembered his very words perfectly over all these years. She did not speak Cantonese. However could she have recalled his speech and his intonation so exactly? That was uncanny, Ah-Suk thought, for he might have taken her by her visitation for a true native of Guangdong. In the street the men were pooling their shillings, while the streetwalker stood by. There came a whistle blast from near the quays, and then a shout of warning from the duty sergeant, and then running footsteps approaching. Ah Suk watched the men scatter, and formed his resolution in his mind. He would return to Kanyeri that very evening, clear all his belongings from his cottage, and make for the hills. There he would apply himself wholly to the task of turning the ground. He would save every flake of dust he came upon, and live as simply as he was able, until he had amassed a total of 5 ounces. He would not take opium until he held 5 ounces in his hand. He would not drink. He would not gamble. He would eat only the cheapest and plainest of foods. But the very moment that he reached this target, he would return to Hokitika. He would change the metal at the Grey and Buller Bank. He would walk across the thoroughfare to Tigreen's Hardware and Supply. He would lay his paper note upon the countertop. He would purchase a store of shot, a tin of black powder, and a gun. Then he would walk to the Palace Hotel, climb the stairs, open Carver's door, and take his life. And after that, Ah Suk exhaled again. After that, nothing. After that, his life would come full circle, and he could rest at last. Part 3. The House of Self-Undoing. The 20th of March, 1866. 42 degrees 43 minutes south. 170 degrees 58 minutes east. Mercury in Aquarius, in which Moody passes on some vital information, and Sukyong Sheng presents him with a gift. On the morning of the 20th of March, Walter Moody rose before the dawn, rang for hot water, and washed, standing at the window, looking over the rooftops as the navy pre-dawn sky faded to grey, then pale blue, then the splendid yellow of a fresh yolk, by which time he was dressed and descending the stairs and calling for his toast to be buttered and his eggs boiled hard. En route to the dining room, he lingered in the hallway, leaning his ear towards the door of a locked chamber at the foot of the stairs. After listening a moment, he perceived a grainy, rhythmic sound, and continued on, satisfied that the room's inhabitant was still very sound asleep. The Crown dining room was empty save for the intermittent presence of the cook, who stifled a yawn as he brought Moody's pot of tea, and another as he delivered the morning edition of the West Coast Times, the pages slightly damp from the chill of the night. Moody scanned the paper as he ate. The front page was composed chiefly of repeat notices. The banks offered competing terms of interest, each promising the very best price for gold. The hoteliers boasted the various distinctions of their hotels. The grocers and warehousemen listed a full inventory of their wares, and the shipping news reported which passengers had lately departed and which passengers had lately arrived. The second page of the paper was taken over by a long and rather spiteful review of the latest show at the Prince of Wales, so poor in quality as to defy, because it is beneath, criticism, and several gossipy correspondences from goldfield speculators in the north. Moody turned to the social notices as he finished his second egg, and his eyes came to rest upon a pair of names he recognised. A modest ceremony had been planned. No date had yet been determined. There would be no honeymoon. Cards and other expressions of congratulation could be addressed care of the prospective groom, who took his nightly lodging at the Palace Hotel. Moody was frowning as he folded the paper, wiped his mouth, and rose from the table. But it was not the engagement, nor the fact of its announcement, that preoccupied his thinking as he returned upstairs to fetch his hat and coat. It was the matter of the forwarding address. For Moody knew very well that Francis Carver no longer lodged at the Palace Hotel. His rooms at the palace stood as before, with his frock coat hanging in the armoire, his trunk set out at the foot of the bed, and his bedclothes mussed and strewn about. He still broke his fast in the palace dining room every morning and drank whisky in the palace parlour every night. He still paid his weekly board to the palace proprietor, who, as far as Moody had been able to ascertain, remained quite unaware that his most notorious guest was paying £2 weekly for an unoccupied room. The fact of Carver's nightly relocation was not commonly known, and were it not for the accident of their conjunction, Moody might also have remained ignorant of the fact that Carver had slept every night since the night of the widow's séance at the Crown, in a small room next to the kitchen that afforded an unobstructed view up the rutted length of the Canieri Road. By 7:30, Moody was striding eastward along Gibson Quay, dressed in a grey slouch hat, yellow moleskin trousers, leather knee boots, and a dark woollen coat over a shirt of grey serge. He now donned this costume 6 days out of seven, much to the amusement of Gascoigne, who had asked him more than once why he had chosen to leave off the piratical red sash, which might have finished off the ensemble very nicely. Moody had staked a claim close enough to Hokitika to permit his continued board at the Crown Hotel. This arrangement cut into his weekly earnings rather severely, but he preferred it to sleeping in a tent beneath the open sky, something he had attempted only once, to his great discomfort. It took him 1 hour and 20 minutes to walk to his claim from Hokitika. Before the clock struck 9 every morning, therefore, he was at his cradle at the creekside, hauling pails of water, whistling, and shovelling sand. Moody was not, truth be told, a terribly skilful prospector. He was hoping for nuggets rather than panning for dust. Too often the ore-bearing gravel slipped through the netting at the bottom of the cradle, only to be washed away. Sometimes he emptied his cradle twice over without finding any flakes at all. He was making what the diggers called pay dirt, meaning that the sum total of his weekly income was more or less equal to the sum total of his weekly expenditure, but it was a holding pattern he could not sustain. He knew that he ought to heed popular advice and go mates with another man or with a party. The chance of striking rich was doubled in a partnership, and the chances multiplied still further in a party of 5 or 7 or 9. But his pride would not permit it. He persevered alone, visualizing every hour the nugget with which he would buy his future life. His dreams at night began to glister, and he began to see flashes of light in the most unlikely places, such that he had to look again and blink or close his eyes. Stepping across the small creek that formed the northern boundary of his claim, Moody was surprised to see the pale silhouette of a tent through the scrub, and beside it the remains of a fire. He came up short. The Hokitika diggers typically spent their weekends in town, not returning to the field until mid-morning on Monday at the very earliest. Why had this digger not joined his fellows? And what was he doing on another man's patch of land?
"Hello there!"
Moody called, meaning to rouse the tent's inhabitant.
"Hello!"
At once there came a grunt and a flurry of motion inside the tent.
"Sorry," someone said. "Very sorry, very sorry."
A Chinese face appeared at the opening, blurred with sleep.
"No trouble," he said. "Very sorry."
"Mr. Sook?" said Moody.
Ah Sook squinted up at him.
"I'm Walter Moody," Moody said, placing his hand over his heart. Do you remember me?"
"Yes, yes."
Ah Sook knuckled his eyes with his fist.
"I'm so glad," said Moody. "This is my claim, you see, from this creek here to those yellow pegs on the southern side."
"Very sorry,"
Ah Sook said.
"No harm done."
"No, of course," Moody said. "In any case, Ah Sook, I'm pleased to see you. Your absence from Canieri has been noted by a great many people, myself included. I'm very pleased to see you. Very pleased, not angry at all. We feared that something had happened to you."
"No trouble," the hatter said. "Tent only. No trouble."
He disappeared from sight.
"I can see you're not causing trouble," Moody said. "It's all right, Mr. Sook. I'm not worried about you making camp. I'm not worried about that at all."
Ah Sook clambered out of the tent, pulling his tunic down as he did so.
"I will go," he said. "5 minutes."
He held up 5 fingers.
"It's all right," Moody said. "You can sleep here if you like. It's of no consequence to me."
"Last night only," said Ah Sook.
"Yes, but if you want to tent here tonight also, I don't mind a bit," said Moody.
His manner was alternating between bluff cheer and clumsy condescension, as it might if he were speaking to someone else's child.
"Not tonight,"
said Ah Sook. He began to strike his tent. hauling the canvas fly, still wet with dew, from the rope over which it had been draped, he revealed the flattened square of earth where he had spent the night. The woolen blanket, twisted and pressed flat with the tangled imprint of his body, a pot filled with sand, his leather purse, a panning dish, a string bag containing tea and flour and several wrinkled potatoes. A standard issue swag. Moody, casting his eye over this meagre inventory, was oddly touched.
"I see," he said. "But where have you been, Mr. Sook, this month past? It's been a full month since the séance, and no one's heard a word from you."
"Digging,"
said our Sook, flattening the canvas fly across his chest.
"You vanished so soon after the séance," Moody continued. "We rather thought you'd gone the same way as poor old Mr. Staines. No one could make head or tails of it, you disappearing like that."
Our Sook had been folding the fly into quarters. Now he paused.
"Mr. Staines come back?"
"I'm afraid not," Moody said. "He's still missing."
"And Francis Carver?"
"Carver's still in Hokitika." Our Sook nodded.
"At the Palace Hotel?"
"Well, in actual fact, no," said Moody, pleased to be given an opportunity to conspire. "He's begun sleeping at the Crown Hotel, in secret. Nobody knows he's staying there. He's kept up the pretense that he's staying at the palace, and he still pays rent to the palace proprietor, and keeps his rooms just as before. But he sleeps every night at the Crown. He arrives well after nightfall and leaves very early. I only know because I rent the room above." Our Sook had fixed him with a penetrating look.
"Where?"
"Carver's room? Or mine?"
"Carver."
"He sleeps in the room next to the kitchen, on the ground floor," said Moody. "It faces east, very near the smoking room where you and I first met."
"A humble room," said Our Sook.
"Very humble," Moody agreed. "But he's got a vantage down the length of the Canieri Road. He's keeping watch, you see. He's watching out for you." Walter Moody knew virtually nothing about Our Sook's history with Francis Carver, for Our Sook had not had the opportunity at the Crown Hotel to narrate the tale in any detail, and had not been seen since, save for his appearance at the Wayfarer's Fortune 1 month ago. Moody wished very much to know the full particulars, but despite his best efforts of surveillance and inquiry, he had become an adept at turning idle conversation discreetly to provocative themes. His understanding had not developed beyond what he had learnt in the smoking room of the Crown, which was that the history concerned opium, murder, and a declaration of revenge. Ah Kui was the only man to whom Ah Sook had narrated the tale in full, and he did not, alas, possess language enough to share it with any English-speaking man.
"Every night at the Crown Hotel?"
said Our Sook.
"Tonight?"
"Yes, he'll be there tonight," said Moody, "though not until well after dark, as I've told you."
"Not the palace?"
"No, not the palace," said Moody. "He changed hotels."
"Yes," said Our Sook gravely. "I understand."
He went to loose the knot of his guy rope from the fork of a tree. "Who was he?" said Moody. "The murdered man."
"My father," said Our Sook.
"Your father?" said Moody. After a moment he said, "How was he killed? I mean, forgive me, but what happened?"
"A long time ago," said Our Sook. "Before the war."
"The Ethiopian Wars," said Moody, prompting him.
"Yes,"
said Our Sook, but he did not go on. He began to reel in the guy rope, using his forearm as a spool.
"What happened?"
said Moody.
"Prophet,"
said Our Sook, giving his explanation flatly. "Prophet of what kind?" Clearly Our Sook thought this was a very stupid question. Perceiving this, Moody rushed on to ask another.
"I mean, was your father... was he in the opium business, as you are?"
Our Sook said nothing. He withdrew his forearm from the loop of rope, twisted it into a figure eight, and secured it onto his swag. Once it was affixed, he sat back on his haunches, regarded Moody coolly for a moment, and then leant over and spat very deliberately into the dirt. Moody drew back.
"Forgive me," he murmured. "I ought not to pray."
Walter Moody had told nobody at all that Crosby Wells was the bastard brother of the politician Lauderback. He had decided in the hours following this discovery that the intelligence was not his to share. His reasons for this concealment were deeply felt, but vaguely articulated. A man should not be made to answer for his family. It was wrong to expose a man's private correspondence without his consent. He did not want to perform this exposure himself, but these reasons, even when taken together, did not quite comprise the whole truth, which was that Moody had compared himself to both men many times over the past month and felt a profound kinship with each of them, though in very different ways. With the bastard, for his desperation, with the politician, for his pride. This double comparison had become the habitual project of his meditations every day, as he stood in the chill water and ran clods of earth and metal through his hands. Arsuk stuffed the last of his possessions into his swag, and then sat down upon it to lace his boots. Moody could not bear it any longer. He burst out,
"You know you will be hanged. If you take Carver's life, you will be hanged. They'll take your life, Mr. Sook, if you take his, no matter what your provocation."
"Yes," said Arsuk, "I understand. It will not be a fair trial. Not for you."
"No,"
Arsuk agreed. The prospect did not appear to distress him. He knelt by the fire, picked up a twig, and stirred the damp earth that he had placed over the embers the night before. Below the earth, the coals were still warm, dark as matted blood.
"What are you going to do?" said Moody, watching him. "Shoot him down."
"Yes,"
said Arsuk.
"When?"
said Moody.
"Tonight,"
said Arsuk.
"At the Crown Hotel."
He appeared to be digging for something beneath the coals. Presently his stick struck something hard. Using the end as a lever, he flipped the object out onto the grass. It was a little tin tea caddy, black with soot. The box was evidently still hot. He wrapped his sleeve around his hand before he picked it up.
"Show us your arms," said Moody.
Arsuk looked up.
"Go on, and show us your arms," said Moody, suddenly flushed. "There are pistols, and there are pistols, Mr. Sook. You have to know your powder, as my own father used to say."
It was rare he quoted his father in company, Adrian Moody's habitual phrases being in general unsuitable to civil conversation, and Walter Moody being in general disinclined to reference him.
"I buy a pistol," said Arsuk.
"Good," said Moody. "Where is it?"
"Not yet,"
said Arsuk.
"You haven't bought it yet."
"Today,"
said Arsuk. He opened the caddy and poured a handful of golden flakes into his palm. Moody realized that he must have buried the box in the earth beneath his fire in case he was robbed during the night.
"What kind of pistol are you going to buy?"
"From Tigreen's."
With his free hand, he reached for his purse.
"What manufacture, I meant? What kind?"
"Tigreen's,"
said Arsuk again. He opened the mouth of the purse one-handed to transfer the gold into it.
"That's the name of the store," Moody said. "What kind of pistol are you going to buy? Are you a weapons man?"
"To shoot Francis Carver,"
said Arsuk.
"Tigreen's won't do for you," Moody said, shaking his head. "You might go there to buy a fowling piece, or a rifle of some kind, but they won't furnish you with a pistol. A military weapon is what you want. Not every ball of shot will kill a man, you see, and the last thing you want is to do the job by halves. Heavens, Mr. Sook, a pistol is not just a piece of hardware,
just as a horse is not merely a mode of transport," he said, rounding off this comparison rather lamely. Arsuk did not reply. He had chosen Tigreen's Hardware and Supply for two reasons. Firstly, because the store was located beside the Palace Hotel, and secondly, because the shopkeeper was sympathetic to Chinese men. The first consideration no longer mattered, of course, but the second consideration was an important one. Arsuk had planned to ask Mr. Tigreen to load the piece for him in the store, so that the deed could be carried out the very same day. He had never fired a pistol. He knew the basic principles behind the design, however, and he guessed it was not a skill that required a great deal of practice. "Go to the outfitters on Camp Street," Moody said, "right beside the Deutsches Gasthaus, the building that shows the peak of the roof behind the Sham. The sign isn't painted yet, but the proprietors are Brunton, Solomon and Barnes, and the door should be open. When you get there, ask for a Kerr patent. Don't let them sell you anything else. It's a British military piece, very sound, and it will do the job. The cost for a Kerr patent is £5 even. Any more than £5 and they're robbing you."
£5?
Ah-Suk looked down at the gold in his purse. He had had no idea that a pistol could be got for such a reasonable sum. He had been quoted a figure twice that much.
"Kerr patent," he repeated to remember it. "Camp Street. Thank you, Mr. Moody."
"What are you going to do," Moody said, "when the deed is done? When Carver's dead? Will you turn yourself in? Will you try to make a run for it?" All of a sudden, he felt absurdly excited. But Ah-Suk only shook his head. He closed the mouth of his purse and then wrapped the purse tightly in a square of cloth. At last he rose, swinging his swag onto his back as he did so, and tucking the bundled object very carefully into his pocket.
"This claim," he said, gesturing, "pay dirt only, very small gold."
Moody waved his hand. "Yes, I know."
"Not bound us here," said Ah-Suk.
"No homeward bound us," said Moody, nodding. "You needn't spell it out, Mr. Suk. I know the truth of it." Ah-Suk peered at him.
"Go north," he said. "Black sands. Very lucky in the north. No nuggets here. Too close to town."
"Charleston," said Moody. "Yes, there's fortunes to be made in Charleston." Ah-Suk nodded.
"Black sands," he said.
He stepped forward, and Moody saw that he was holding the soot-blackened tea caddy in both hands. He proffered it, and Moody, surprised, extended his own hands to receive it. Ah-Suk did not release the gift at once. He bowed low over it, and Moody, copying him, bowed also.
"Chokney Hawan," said Ah-Suk.
But he provided no translation, and Moody did not ask for one.